Okay. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming back. Thank you to those of you who are new here. It's good to see lots of you here. I wanted to spend some time this week speaking about the topic of angels. We began our topic last week speaking about demons, and we had our friend in the front who was a little scary. This week, these people look a little friendlier, these angels over here in the front. I Googled angels, and these were the first people that came up. Just out of curiosity, I thought I would begin by asking a question, and that is, what's the number one thing you realize when you see this picture of these angels in the front over here? What's the most glaring fact about them?
They're so young.
Right, they're young. There's like these little babies. And there's sort of this perception, true or not, that for some reason, by definition, angels are going to be these little babies, these little cherubic faces that have these cute wings. And
Wouldn't you call those cherubs and not angels? Yeah.
Okay, right. Well, according to Google Images, no. I don't honestly know the difference between a cherub and an angel. Is there a someone look it up and let me know. But for all intents and purposes, we'll assume that at least for now, they're the same thing. And the question really is this what an angel looks like? And if not, then what do they look like? And the same as we asked last week, do we actually believe that they exist? Right, and so if you remember when we spoke about demons, there was this very clear distinction between two different opinions. One opinion held that we do believe that demons exist, and how could you say otherwise? Because if you look throughout the Talmud and various statements of our rabbis, it's clear that the rabbis believe they exist, so who are we to say otherwise? However, others were of the opinion that no, actually, they do not exist, and when the rabbis were talking about demons, perhaps they meant other things. Maybe they meant things like germs that we can now identify more clearly nowadays, or maybe they meant, as we spoke about, psychological demons, inner demons, but not actually the little scary guy with a pitchfork. That's not what we were talking about. And so this week, I do want to speak about angels, and I'll begin by posing a question to the crowd, and that is, can anyone think of a specific proof, perhaps, that we believe that angels are real much more definitively than we did with demons? Any thoughts? Okay, good. Right, if you look in the Torah, if you look in our scripture, it's very clear that angels appear all the time. Our avos, our forefathers, and our foremothers, they're always talking to angels, they're always having interactions with angels, some more than others, which is of course very interesting, why it is that certain figures seem to have angels come up a lot more frequently. In particular, Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, he has more interactions with angels than any of the others, at least in the book of Bereishis, in the very first book of the Torah. But angels come up all the time. And since they come up all the time, we are led to believe that they are certainly either much more present, if not actually much more real, than our friends last week, the demons. And I want to begin by going through just a few specific sources in which the Torah either explicitly or implicitly talks about angels, and try to understand who these figures are and what they are really all about. So if you take a look, and there are extra source sheets here if in case anyone didn't get. If you take a look at source number one, so this is a passage that we find with Avraham, and Avraham encounters these interesting figures. You'll note that I actually did not look at the English translation yet over here, but the Hebrew text is very clear that these were not angels, these were just three men that he encounters. But we'll see in a moment why it's clear that we are talking about angels. So let's take a look inside. Hashem appeared to him, to Avraham, by the terebinths of Mamre. He was sitting at the entrance of the tent as the day grew hot. Looking up, he saw three figures standing near him. Perceiving this, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them, and bowing to the ground, he said, "My lords, if it please you, do not go on past your servants. Let a little water be brought, bathe your feet, and recline under the tree, and let me fetch a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves." So clearly we have Avraham in his classic state over here, which was that he was very into chesed, into kindness, and specifically into welcoming and guests. That was sort of his general MO. He always was very big into that. And so he sees these three strangers that to him look like three men, and he says, please come on inside, wash your feet. And the commentaries explain, why was he telling them to wash their feet? Anyone know? Yeah, they're right. They had dirt on their feet, but why was he so concerned about them washing it off? Okay, good. So there are those who explain that these individuals, or certainly how they appeared to him, looked like the sect of individuals that prayed and bowed down to the ground. And so he was concerned that they would be coming in with the dirt on their feet. And again, from their perception, that this dirt was their god. And so that's why he had them wash off their feet, so that they don't bring in a foreign god into his house. So as far as we understand thus far, does Avraham think that these individuals are angels? No, they're just people. In fact, they're the locals who bow down to the ground. Okay, let's keep going. Then go on. And seeing that you have come your servant's way, they replied, do as you have said. Avram hastened into the tent to Sarah and said, quick, three seahs of choice flour, knead and make them cakes. Then Abraham ran to the herd, took a calf tender and choice and gave it to a servant boy who hastened to prepare it. And he took curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. And he waited on them under the tree as they ate. What's another interesting thing? If these are indeed angels, what's odd about this story?
He mixed milk and meat.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about the milk and meat in 1 second.
They ate.
Okay, good. They ate. Everything we know, certainly these friendly, did we decide cherubs and angels, are they the same thing?
No.
Inconclusive. They're not. Oh, they're not.
Not necessarily inconclusive. It says, and you know, there's all kinds of stuff. That's yeah. The first thing that came up. Mysterious as they are, angels in the Bible are often described with human qualities, even speaking like people and bearing human-sounding names. Also, they do not appear to have wings. The cherubim are equally mysterious, said to have wild human and animal-like features, and yes, these beings have wings.
Ah, interesting. Okay. And who, this was Google? Rabbi Google? All right. Okay. But so for all intents and purposes, for now, we'll assume that they're more or less the same thing. Perhaps another time we can get a little bit more into the nitty gritty. But yes, right. So angels, we assume if they are spiritual beings, that they are not going to be eating, because why would a spiritual being need to eat? And so the fact that Abraham is feeding them, and not just that he's feeding them, but that they said, yes, please bring us the food, right? They could have just said, it's okay. We already ate, right? If they're trying to put on an act, they could have continued the act. But no, they said, yeah, bring out the food. We'll enjoy our delicious feast. And because they didn't, it seems that maybe these aren't angels, or maybe these aren't angels that we would typically understand them to be. So, and in terms of the meat and the milk, that's a great question. Anyone know a potential answer as to how Abraham, our forefather of Judaism, how he could be serving meat and milk when we believe that's a general prohibition? Okay, good. So the easiest way to get around it is to say that we were not given the dietary laws at this point, and so he did not need to uphold them. The problem with that is that there are various statements of the rabbis that say that our forefathers did keep all the dietary laws and all the laws of the Torah. So it's a longer conversation for another time, but it is a good question. Yeah, Patty, what did you say?
If he thought they were locals, he would not impose his customs upon them.
Okay.
They let them choose. If he's the host, he's not going to impose on the guest.
Right. Well, so the problem over here is that it seems like he's serving them together. It's not entirely clear. But okay, all good questions. Yeah, Patty, wonderful point. Okay, right. So that's similar to what Patty was saying, that he sort of, here, more source sheets over here. Send them down to.
Yeah, but you wouldn't serve if you kept the right, so, close your house.
Yeah,
I'm not going to serve my next door neighbor ham in my house.
Right. Even as respectful as we want to be, we're still going to upkeep the laws of our own household. Okay, all good points.
One commentary is he offered the choice.
Oh, okay, good. Sorry, perhaps it was that he offered them a choice. Okay, all wonderful thoughts. Not our topic for right now. Okay, so let's keep going further. So they said to him, where is your wife Sarah? And he replied, there in the tent. Then one said, I will return to you next year, and your wife Sarah shall have a son. Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. Sarah had stopped having her periods, and Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "Now that I've lost the ability, am I to have enjoyment with my husband so old?" Then Hashem said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I in truth bear a child?'" etc., etc. Ultimately, these angels tell her that she is going to have a child at this ripe old age, nearly 100 in her 90s, and as a result, it seems like towards the end of the story, if Avraham did not realize that these were angels, probably by the end he understands that they are. Why? Right, because they're giving him some sort of a prophecy. One could make the argument that maybe they are just prophets and not angels, but it would seem that based on the context towards the end of the story, it becomes clear to Avram and to Sarah that these are men of God and these are not just regular people, that they probably are angels. Yes?
I have a problem with the translation.
Yeah, go on.
In that, first of all, this translation uses the words periods.
Yeah.
That was not a terminology.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
So, much of this in translation that doesn't agree with other translations.
100%. Yeah, don't. This was a translation I just found online quickly. Don't judge by the translation. It gets the general gist of what we need to know right now. But yes, fair enough. It's not a perfect translation. Okay, so let's see a few more sources that talk about angels. So again, we have this first source over here, this encounter that Avram had with... Okay, right, good. So this first encounter that Avram had with three men and not three angels, that we, and the commentary certainly all, I think you'd be hard out to find a single commentary who does not believe that these are angels. But again, the text says that these are men and not angels, which then leads us to the fact that we are going to have to encounter at some point, and that is that when the Torah says men, does it always mean men? And when the Torah says angels, does it actually mean angels? Right? If the term men over here, if so many are understanding this, that it's not actually men, but it's angels, then perhaps the Torah is not always literal when it's talking about the actual figure, that there is another, maybe someone who was perceived as an angel, such a holy spirit and a holy person, but not actually an angelic figure. So these are sort of questions that we'll have to keep in mind. So take a look at source number two. This is our forefather Yaakov Avinu, Jacob, and here's what the text says. Early in the morning, Lavan kissed his sons and daughters and bade them goodbye. Then Lavan left on his journey homeward. Yaakov went on his way, and messengers of God encountered him. The Torah uses the actual word for Malachai Elohim, which literally would be understood as angels of God. When he saw them, Jacob said, "This is God's camp," right? He said it was God's camp because, how do you know it was God's camp? Because he saw angels. So if he's out here, there's two angels standing over here, it must be that this is where God is, or this is one of the areas he hangs out, or that's theologically complicated, but we're not going to delve into that right now. He named that place Machanayim, and Jacob sent messengers. Again, it seems like we're talking about angels that he sent again ahead to his brother Esav in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. So over here again, we have angels that come up in the text, but this time they're not men, they are literally angels. And if you want to understand it literally, which we have no reason not to at this point, so we're going to understand that these are actually angels. Okay, and let's see one more source, and that is from this past week's Torah portion, right? We read in the Parsha of Vayechi that Yaakov, he blessed his two grandsons, Menasha and Ephraim, and he says the words, "Hamalach ha-goel osi mikol ra," that the messenger, the angel, who has redeemed me from all harm, that this angel too should bless the children. In them may my name be recalled, in the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they be teeming multitudes upon the earth. So here too we have another interaction with angels and a reference to angels. It's clear that as far as the Torah stands and where the Torah is coming from, that angels are a very present part of the culture and of our religion and of our belief system. So with all of this said, we now understand that angels are more present than our friends the demons last week. The question, however, is, what are angels, right? So you could say it a million times. Are they these cherubic figures? Are they something else? Are they similar to demons in some ways? Are they similar to people? What exactly are we to make of them? And so I brought for you a statement from the Talmud in source number 4, in which our rabbis understand that angels and demons and people all share certain traits according to our tradition, but that there are certain traits that each of them have that are unique from one another. So let's take a look in inside source number 4, but make specific notes of the bolded statements, because those statements are there's an understanding that this is what the angels have. So the sages taught, 6 statements were said with regard to demons. In 3 ways they are like ministering angels, and in 3 ways they are like humans. The Brita specifies in 3 ways they are like ministering angels. So again, these are going to be traits of the ministering angels. Number 1, they have wings. Number 2, they fly from one end of the world to the other. And number 3, they know what will be in the future. So these are 3 traits that evidently we believe that angels, and by the way, that demons also have, but that we believe the angels have. And then let's skip ahead a little further towards that final paragraph with the bolded words there. And the Brita explains in 3 ways they are like ministering angels, that they have intelligence, that they walk upright. This is actually people, how people are similar to angels, so that we have a brain. We have the ability to cognitively process things. Then angels have that too. They walk upright, and we too also walk upright, and they speak in the holy tongue. Angels have the ability to speak Hebrew, and we also have the ability to speak Hebrew. What do we see from here? If you were to see an angel on the street, would you know that it was an angel? Okay, some people say no, some people say yes. So if you say no, why not?
Because no wings.
well, no, it says that they do have wings.
The angels don't.
Well, according to this statement of the Gemara, they do have wings.
Well, okay.
But even so, right? So I'll defend you, because I think you could be right. Right? So all of these things are not necessarily traits that would be noticeable if you see someone on the street. Because again, maybe the angels have a human-looking figure. Okay, they have wings. Okay, they put a coat on, so you don't see the wings anymore. I don't know. How complicated could it be to cover up wings? Anyone know? Oh, it was a trick question. okay, right. Yeah?
Is it possible, because angels could disguise themselves as human,
yeah,
so is demon?
Could be, 100%.
I mean, I'm thinking of
anyone a demon?
I'm thinking of all those killers that kills people on the street and everything. Could that be demon?
100%, yeah. I mean, I think it's just a bad person, but could be. All right, and for those people who said that, who answered yes to the question. Yeah. All right. So maybe they would be noticeable. It's actually not that easy to hide wings, and so you would know that an angel was in front of you. Okay. So with all of this said, I want to jump forward in history. So we started with the Torah. The Torah clearly talks about angels a lot. The rabbis clearly talk about angels, and they discuss the traits. There are various statements of the Talmud that discuss what they actually look like. More than this, there are those who explain that angels do not look like these cherubic figures in the front, but I believe I brought one of the sources, but we'll just say it outside first, that there are those who believe that an angel is actually quite scary to look at, right? Because if you'd imagine a purely spiritual being, our eyes are not normally equipped to handle such a thing, and so there are those who explain that an angel might look like a ball of fire, or it might have several heads, or something of the like, which again, that's how we normally think of demons, and so we don't like to think of an angel, which they're supposed to be so cute. We're not supposed to think of them to be scary, but they don't have to. They could look scary and still be a kind or spiritual and positive force in the world. They may just, you know, maybe they don't fit in so well. And so, with all of that said, I want to now try and understand what the various commentators throughout time think, right? So as we get, quote-unquote, more sophisticated throughout human history, specifically into the medieval ages, right? So the Rishonim, the group of rabbis that lived during the time of the Middle Ages, so how do they view angels? And interestingly, as we will see, just like the demons, there was a clear split among, anyone remember who the main two characters that we spoke about were? That Good. So the Rambam Maimonides and Ramban Nachmanides, they had this dispute regarding angels, regarding demons, that the Rambam Maimonides said that demons, they're not real at all. And the Ramban Nachmanides says, what are you talking about? Of course they are real. And so they had that same dispute regarding the angels as well, albeit a little bit more different and a little bit more sophisticated, I would say. Take a look at source number 5. This is the writings of the Rambam. So what the Rambam says, I'll stress also that whereas the Rambam is clear that demons are not something that we have to contend with in this world, angels, it's not entirely the case, and it would be incorrect to say that he doesn't believe in them, because again, it's so clear that they are an element of the world that we live in, because the Torah literally talks about them. However, there's a question. Are angels these cute little babies that we have on the front of the source sheet? Or are angels maybe something more mystical and just beyond our comprehension, right? The notion of like thinking of things like Mother Nature and those types of things, which generally are not necessarily Jewish terms, right? We don't believe in a Mother Nature. We believe in God, that God controls the world. But the question is how does God control the world? Does he do everything on his own? Does he have any people that work for him? Yeah. Okay.
Came up that it looked like some scary thing that you wouldn't think of, almost like in Nope, but like sort of with an eye in the
middle. Right.
Sort of with wings.
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
And not so pleasant.
Yeah, not so pleasant.
Not
yeah.
There, nope.
Nope. Yeah, what? I don't know. I'm not familiar with. All right, you'll tell us about the movie later. It's oh, okay. Interesting. All right, so 100%. So it seems like the most simple understanding of what an angel looks like, it's that it's probably not this cherubic figure. But so now going back to this dispute as to how we understand what the angels actually are, so you'll see that the Rambam, it's not that he doesn't believe in angels, it's just that he doesn't seem to believe that they are actually real figures, more that they are to be understood and interpreted as forces in the world, right? Forces that are controlled by God, right? This is a critical element of Judaism that most other religions do not hold of, and that is that in Judaism, God is in control of the good and the bad. That's how why people are allowed to ask the question of how could bad things happen if God is the one who's controlling the world? Question for another time, perhaps. Since in Judaism we believe that God is controlling everything, so he could control it in any which way he wants. He could theoretically have created, these little cute babies to go around flying and taking care of his business, or he could have created forces in the world. And that's what the Rambam says. Take a look in source number 5. What is meant by the prophet's statements that they saw an angel of fire or with wings? All of these are prophetic visions and parables. As it says, God, your Lord, is consuming fire, though he is not fire, and the description of him in this manner is only metaphoric. Right? So this is, a classic now that we can see. This is becoming a pattern from the Rambam this week and last week. Any sort of overly mystical elements of the Torah, he'll always assume that it's a parable, it's a metaphor, it's not to be taken literally. Similarly, it says in Psalms, he makes his angels as winds. Since they possess no body, what separates the form of the angels from each other? Their existence is not alike, he says. Rather, each one is below the level of the other, and exists by virtue of its influence and a progression of levels, one above the other. Everything exists by virtue of the influence of the Holy One, blessed be He, and His goodness. And he says, so we understand from what the Rambam is saying thus far, that any single time you see angels or things like that in the text of the Torah, these are metaphors and these are not to be taken literally. No one actually ever saw an angel. They had a dream or they had something where they perceived that it was an angel, but that was not in their imagination, but in a higher process of a prophecy or a vision of something of the like. Rather, the Rambam says, that angels, quote-unquote, are these forces, and there are various levels to the forces. There are some superior forces, perhaps something that we might refer to as gravity, right? We understand now in the year, before the year 2023, but certainly in the year 2023, we know there's something called gravity. So from what the Rambam is describing, and by the way, even in the language of those who believe that there are angels among us, right? So what is gravity? It's probably a force that is controlled by an angel. That's how we would understand it, right? So Rambam would say that gravity is a force, and gravity, in a sense, is an angel. Others might say that gravity is a force that is sort of overseen by an angelic figure. That's Mr. Gravity over there, and that's Mr. What's another force in the world? Give me a force. Physics people, anyone? No? No one? All right. Come on. Someone has to know another. There's gravity. What else is there? Wind. Magnetism. Good. Right? So all these things that either it's a force, and the Rambam would say that's an angel, or others might say that no, it actually is an angel controlling that worldly power. Okay. So let's keep going further and try to understand the Rambam a little bit better. Solomon alluded to this concept in his wisdom, saying, because above the one who is high, there is a watcher, the expression below the level of the other does not refer to a height in a spatial sense, as one might say he is sitting higher than his colleague, but rather in regard to spiritual level. So if you skip ahead a few lines, you'll see that what the Rambam does is that he actually explains how there are different categories, right? There's something like gravity, something like magnetism, and these types of major forces, and then there are smaller, simpler forces that may not be controlled by such a supreme force. And so you take a look, the different names with which the angels are called reflect their spiritual levels. There are the holy chayot, who are above all the others, the ofanim, the erelim, the chashmalim, the srafim, right? These are various words that the rabbis and the Torah and other texts throughout Jewish history have used to describe these angelic figures, and these are categories. Some of them are higher than others, some of them have more powers than others. Of course, at the end of the day, they are all overseen by God, but as far as the Rambam is concerned, these are not angels, but they're forces in the world. And if you take a look in a similar source, in source number 6, right, so the Rambam has two major works that we are aware of. He has other works, but probably the two most famous ones. One is the Mishnah Torah, right, in which he codifies all of Halacha and all of Jewish law, and that was what we just read from. And then he also has something called Mor Nebuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed, in which it's a slightly more philosophical work. And so take a look inside, in source number 6, in his Guide for the Perplexed. He says, we have already stated above that the angels are incorporeal. This agrees with the opinion of Aristotle. Anyone have an issue with the fact that he is quoting Aristotle? Right, so there are those who say very famously, the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, who was one of the most significant rabbis of the last 1,000 years. He lived in the 1700s in Vilna, and he often took issue with the Rambam, which, again, if for anyone who knows the hierarchical view and take that we have in Judaism and Jewish texts, usually if you have a rabbi who lives 500 years later, we generally say he doesn't have the right to disagree with the rabbi who came before him. So the Rambam was around 1100, 1200 or so, and the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, was around in the 1700s, but the Gra was seen as such an advanced thinker and rabbi that he is allowed to, I don't know who makes these rules, but he is allowed to disagree with the Rambam, and so he takes issue many times with the Rambam when he says these more controversial statements, like, for example, how the view of angels is actually like what Aristotle says, and the Gra will tell you that this is the Rambam being overly consumed and taken aback by his secular studies and secular knowledge, and he was misled in this context. Again, something that I or you cannot say, but something that the Gra did say. And so let's take a look. So this was controversial that he was saying that this is like Aristotle, but let's see. This agrees with the opinion of Aristotle. There's only this difference in the names employed, that he uses the term, right? Aristotle and philosophy in general uses something called intelligences, and we instead say angels. His theory is that the intelligences are intermediate beings between the prime cause and existing things, and that they affect the motion of the spheres on which the motion the existence of all things depend, right? So essentially, feel free to read the rest on your own, but he goes on to explain how any single time we see angels in the Torah, any single time we see our rabbis talking about angels, no one ever meant it literally. And he goes on and on, which we'll see in a moment, that the Ramban, Nachmanides, is very, very disturbed by this point. So yeah.
So a couple things about that. seems to me that, again, sort of like last week where we didn't have words to describe bad things that can happen to us, if we don't understand why, before Newton, why the apple fell from the tree, that's an angel, that's a force.
Right.
So it's almost like they're naming the forces of nature, again, to explain what's happening that angels are doing, angels of the wind, and because we don't know
100%.
About the Coriolis force and all those things that we have now. So it seems to me just to be the flip side of that, another way to explain maybe the good things.
Natural
that
phenomenon
happen.
That.
Right, just explain the natural world because we don't have natural
100%. And so the Rambam's, the way he interprets all of this is exactly what Patty is saying, that he is just saying that, again, the terms that we understand nowadays as the forces of nature and the various laws of physics and the like, these are terms that perhaps previously they were seen in the world, but they were just referred to as angels because they didn't have a better term. But nowadays we know that there is a more sophisticated language of this. And again, gravity does not rule anything. Magnetism does not rule anything. God oversees these forces. Maybe they were referred to as angels, but God oversees these forces to allow the world to run properly according to how we are expecting it. The Ramban, Nachmanides, says absolutely not. There's no way you can say this. Because if we say that angels are really just forces and that they are not necessarily visible or corporeal in any way, what issue might you run into? The issue that the Rambam deals with in another way, right? And that is that we have so many stories throughout the Torah, throughout our writings and our prophets, that individuals are encountering angels. This is not just like a one-time thing, not a two-time, not a several dozens and if not hundreds perhaps of times in which the Torah records interactions with angels. And so the Rambam has to say that each and every time that the Torah is talking about an angelic interaction, it has to be that it's a vision, a prophecy, but that this is not literal. Or you could just say what the Ramban is about to tell us, that no, it was literal. They had this interaction, and angels, okay, I don't fully understand what angels are, but it's clear that they are a type of being and not just a quote-unquote force. Take a look inside in the Ramban in source number 7. In the book of Mor Nebuchim, it is said that this portion of scripture consists of a general statement followed by a detailed description. So right now we're talking about the story with Avraham encountering those three men. Thus, scripture first says that the Eternal appeared to Abraham in the form of prophetic visions, and then explains in what manner this vision took place, namely, that he, Abraham, lifted up his eyes in the vision, and lo, three men stood by him. And he said, if now I have found favor in thy eyes, this is the account of what he said in the prophetic vision to one of them, namely, their chief. Now, if in the vision there appeared to Abraham only men partaking of food, how then does scripture say, and the Eternal appeared to him, as God did not appear to him in vision or in thought? Such is not found with respect to all the prophecies. And according to his words, Sarah did not knead cakes, nor did Avram prepare a bull. And also Sarah did not laugh. It was all a vision, right? So what's the Ramban saying over here?
Imagination.
I think the opposite.
Yeah.
Right, that there is so many details that the story is telling us. There, the Torah goes in to such an extent and uses so much energy to say that this is how much flour he prepared, this is the type of meat, this was the meat and the dairy, right? All these different things. And if this is not literal, and this if this did not actually happen, who has a vision with such, excuse me, with such specific details? And therefore, says the Ramban, it has to be that this actually took place.
Couldn't it have actually taken place? There were three men, but they weren't really angels.
Right, okay, good. So the devil's advocate argument is that maybe it did take place, but maybe these weren't angels, and that's why the Torah refers to them as men. Right, so yeah, you could go back and forth, but in sweeping terms, this is how the Ramban proves that this is clearly real angels and they are... Sorry? Well, this is how he proves it. I'm not saying that it's definitive proof, but it's how he proves it. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Right, well, no. So what the Rambam would say is that any single time the Torah talks about men that were later interpreted to be angels, he would say that's the lowest level of angel. But let's, you know, understand that's still not a person. That itself was a vision, and these perceived ishim, these perceived men that were thought to be an angel, that is some sort of a force.
So would it be coincidental, crossing cultures, that three wise men?
So when I was in graduate school, I took a number of classes on ancient Near Eastern history, and if you look throughout the texts, it's probably the most theologically compromising area that anyone can study, because of the fact that you see, right, you read the Torah, and not you, someone reads the Torah, and we think it's like in a vacuum, like, wow, this world was amazing. And the reason why we think it was in a vacuum is because it's hard for us to remember, you know, 10 years ago, let alone, you know, 5,000 years ago. But the truth is that the Torah and our forefathers did not grow up in a vacuum, right? They grew up in a world, right, Mesopotamian culture, these types of things were all around in those days, in terms of the early forefathers, and you do see similarities between various religions and various texts, some that seem to be copying Jewish texts, and some Jewish texts that one might say are perhaps copying other texts. So it's a larger conversation, theologically complicated for sure. I believe that there are answers, but not for right now. But yes, you could see parallels. Yeah.
Also a quick question. When I think of angels in that kind of figurative way, they're always women. Not the
babies?
The babies, I don't think, are angels.
No, they're just cherubs. They're not. Okay.
To follow up on
but I
though.
Always think of an angel as a woman figure, a female
okay.
figure.
Okay. All right, so we'll have to see if there's any fact to that. Yeah, in the back.
Have I listened to you, and what I'm hearing is that you are in an eloquent way mapping out a problem that we have. That is, we're all walking with this baggage, mired with this baggage from the Middle Ages that doesn't help us. It's time to say goodbye to things flying from A to B. It's time to say goodbye to wings on the back. And it's time to have, for us in the 20th and 21st century, a more expansive view and powerful view of what an angel is. And we're constantly stuck in this image that we walk around with. And I think it's not fair, you know, simple terms, because if we could start off using the foundation of the 19th and 20th century and factor in that which you're saying, we can go to greater heights and we can have a better understanding of what an angel is. Right now we can't do that because we keep walking around like baby suitcases in the Middle Ages. Likewise, another term, the kinder, the children. Take children, we have big, something that's small, something that's passive, something that does the thing, it's dead, and it's now not just hurts us. So to the success that we could just jettison all this, put it in the corner there, distill that which is good, and factor in the last, this century and the past century, we'd be a lot better off.
Okay, I don't know if I'm saying that exactly.
No, what I would say is that
if you want to follow that perspective, you are absolutely on solid ground, because the Rambam would say that you are 100% spot on. However, as we'll read a little bit further in the Ramban, in Nachmanides, that's not entirely true. He is sort of much more set on this angelic view and how these are literal figures. And so basically, what we come down to in terms of the reality of angels as they were once thought to be, is that in the same way that demons, we spoke about last week, that some people say that they do exist, some people say they don't exist. So that's kind of what the Rambam and the Ramban are arguing over here. So again, if you are troubled by the fact that there are these angelic figures flying around, you have solid ground of what to stand on. If you don't believe, however, then that's okay as well. And so, okay, so with all that said, I apologize. I just want to keep going a little bit. Then if there are any other questions or comments, feel free to share with me afterwards. Let's keep going. Let's read a few further a bit further in the text of the Ramban. So you remember, he was talking about this notion of if Avraham and Sarah were doing all this food preparation and this did not happen, that would be odd to put all this in a vision. Let's keep going. If so, this dream came through a multitude of business like dreams of falsehood. For what is the purpose of showing him all of this? Similarly to the author of the Mor Nebuchim, right? So the Ramban doesn't even want to say the Rambam's name. He just says the author of Mor Nebuchim. Say in the case of the verse, and a man wrestled with him, right? The very famous scene in which our forefather Jacob wrestles with an angel. By the way, does the Torah call the man an angel? No, the Torah calls it a man, that Jacob wrestled with a man, all right? But we understand it typically to be an angel. So when a man wrestled with him, that it was all prophetic vision, right? So the Ramban says, if that was a prophetic vision, how could that be? Because in the case of the verse, and a man wrestled with him, but if this be the case, I do not know why Jacob limped on his thigh when he awoke, right? So if you would say that this was true, that Yaakov just had a vision of fighting with an angel, then how could it be that he actually had a physical ailment afterwards, right? Parenthetically, you might say, if you're the Rambam and you want to say Yaakov, sorry? Sympathy or maybe like psychosomatic or some sort of that there is an understanding that even if he didn't actually physically have a battle, the notion that he limped, it could be maybe psychosomatic or it could be somehow understood in another way, but nonetheless, so that's how the Ramban says, that's why the Rambam is totally wrong. And he says further, and why did Jacob say? For he said the words, for I have seen an angel face to face and my life was preserved. The prophets did not fear that they might die on account of having experienced prophetic visions, etc., etc. He goes on in the final line, or not the final line, but towards the end, I bolded it for you. It is forbidden to listen to them and all the more to believe in them. So anyone who says, like what the Rambam says, he says it's totally prohibited to listen to what they are explaining, because that view of angels is just, it's too rationalistic and it's just not entirely spot on with the reality that we believe in the Jewish tradition. So here... Right. So again, so anyone who says that angels are not real, that they're not these figures, so and you're going to have to contend with this reality that there have been angels that have been named and that there are angels that have clear descriptions throughout Jewish history and in various texts. But what someone like the Rambam would say, well, anyone want to take a guess? What would the Rambam say?
It's metaphorical, or it's representational, not realistic.
Right, and so to say it, you know, very bluntly, right, so what do we call the source that allows this to fall?
Gravity.
What did the rabbis call it?
An angel.
Michael or Gavriel, right? These names these names that we have heard throughout the years that might be associated with actual angelic names. Well, it could be that they decided to call it that if it is indeed a force, because they saw that it has properties that are associated with that name. So again, we call it gravity; they call it the angel Gabriel, whatever you want to call it, and they named it that for a specific reason. But not that the Rambam would say, not that that was actually a figurine that was interacting with the world. Okay, with all of this said, so we see this similar to last week. We have this very clear distinction between these two different perspectives. Those who say, if you want to believe in them, great. Others say, if you don't want to believe in them, also great. What I would like to spend the remaining time discussing and trying to understand is something that I consider to be very relevant for Jewish law nowadays, and that is the notion of praying to angels. And the reason why I say that is because there are several texts that we have in our liturgy. If you open up a siddur, you'll see that there are texts that we have that refer to us praying to the angels in some way, shape, or form. And the question is, again, whether you want to follow the opinion of the Ramban or the Rambam, you believe in them, the question is, are we allowed to recite a text that tells us that we are praying to angels? So anyone want to give me an example? What's a classic example of a text that either we say or some of us say or that is commonly said in a lot of homes? Anyone know? Okay, good. So Shalom Aleichem, right? The Friday night song, Shalom Aleichem, Aleichem, right? So this, the text is literally us talking to the angels. Shalom Aleichem, right? Hello, Malachei Asharis, ministering angels. What we're doing is that we're referring to a statement that our rabbis tell us in the Gemara, that they say that when we come home from Shul on Friday night, we come into our home and we are escorted by angels. The weekday angels leave us and the Shabbos angels join us. So the text of the song Shalom Aleichem was composed because of this belief that angels are with us. What's a problematic element of that song, though? So the third paragraph goes Barchuni l'shalom, right, in which we tell the angels, please angels, bless us. Why might that be problematic? Yeah. Okay, good, because this sort of reeks of idol worship in a sense, because however you want to view an angel, if whether it's a force or an angelic figure, whatever it might be, we don't believe in Judaism, or at least I didn't think we believed in Judaism, that we have the right to pray to other beings. It's God and only God. Again, like we said at the beginning, everything in this world is from God. That is a uniquely Jewish belief, and Judaism is one of the primary religions, if not the primary religion, that sort of believes in this and shared this monotheistic, true monotheistic approach with the world. So how dare we pray to angels? Yeah?
So before you get to Borchuni L'Shalom, you say, Mi Melech Malachei
Amlachim. Yeah.
So who's the angel above?
Right.
Higher than the angels.
Right.
So HaKadosh Baruch
Hu. Right. Okay.
So maybe that Borchuni L'Shalom is speaking God, not the angels.
Okay, could be, right? So if you want to justify it, then you might say that the angels that we're referring to is, in this case, in this context, God. It seems like for other reasons that that's probably not the case, but I'm still going to find a way to justify it anyways, even if it wasn't the case. All right, so let's try to have this conversation for just the final few moments here and understand what the Jewish view on praying to angels might be, and is this something that indeed we could entertain. So we begin by looking at source number 8, in which our rabbis tell us, Rabbi Yochanan said, anyone who requests that his needs be met in the Aramaic language, the ministering angels do not attend to him to bring his prayer before God, as the ministering angels are not familiar with the Aramaic language, but only with the sacred tongue Hebrew exclusively. So I don't know who determined that, but there is a belief and a tradition that if the angels speak any language, they speak Hebrew and only Hebrew and no other language. So back in those days when Aramaic was the commonly spoken language, so there was an ideal to have most of the prayers be in Hebrew and not in Aramaic, so that they would be brought to God quicker through the angels. It does, however, raise the question of why there are some prayers that are specifically in Aramaic. Anyone know some prayers? One prayer in particular, probably the most well-known prayer? Kaddish. Right? Kaddish is in Aramaic. Anyone know why? So there are those who explain that Kaddish is in Aramaic specifically because we don't want the angels interceding. Because there are some times where we need to have that direct connection with the Almighty, and we don't want them to play any role in this, and so therefore we say it in Aramaic so that they specifically don't hear, right? So again, whether you believe in it or not, it's just fascinating that Kaddish is such a powerful prayer that so many of us are familiar with, and the reason why it's in Aramaic is specifically because of this idea that we wanted it to be something that the angels were not involved in. Others might tell you that it's actually because that was the language that everyone spoke, but I think that both are true. Oh, why is it in Aramaic? Because the husbands don't want to know what they owe their wives. That's what. No, honestly, it's a really good question. The ketubah probably should be in English. There are halachic reasons why we assume that it does need to be in Aramaic. However, hopefully a competent rabbi that is marrying off a couple will sit down with the groom and translate every word. So at least the groom will, at one point, know all of the obligations that he has to his wife in the ketubah. But yeah, it's a fair point. It's also, by the way, the ketubah is a legal document. And it's funny sometimes, and this is a very, it's a big custom that a lot of people have, so far be it for me to criticize it, but it's interesting. you know, people hang it up in their homes, they put it in their dining room, and it's just a fascinating custom. I think the only reason why people do that is because they don't know what it means, because it's like putting up a tax return on the wall, right? So that no one would do that, but because we know what the tax return says, right? So the ketubah, you know, people make it very beautiful, and they have like lots of nice artwork, but at the end of the day, it's a legal document. So probably one of the reasons why it was kept in Aramaic after all these years is because people like displaying it so much, so maybe they don't want to ruin it for people and make them take it down from their wall. Because again, if it was in English and it said, "Sir, you owe your wife 2 goats," that's not the most as romantic as a. Just all right. Okay. So with all of this said, let's keep looking at a few more sources. Take a look at source number 9, the Gemara in Brachos. One who enters a bathroom says to the angel who accompanies him at all times, "Be honored, honorable holy ones, servants of the One on High. Give honor to the God of Israel. Leave me until I enter and do my will and come back to you." Abaye said, "A person should not say this, lest they abandon him and go. Rather, he should say, 'Guard me, help me, support me, support me,' etc., etc." Right? What we see over here is that the Gemara was very clearly of the opinion that there are angels always escorting a person, and you don't want to tell them to go, because if you tell them to go, right, they can't go into the bathroom with you because they're too spiritual of a being. So you say wait, and not that you should leave me, because if you say leave, then they might never come back. So these are very, first of all, literal graphic interpretations of what angels are, but more than that, it's also just very clear how critical angels being around the person were in the times of the Gemara. Okay, so what do we believe? So let's now fast forward to the Middle Ages once again and try to get a perspective as to, do we believe, are we okay with praying to angels or not? And so if you take a look in source number 10, it's an excerpt from an article in which the opinion of Rashi is quoted. Numerous Talmudic passages, as plainly interpreted by Rashi, support the permissibility of such prayers. The Talmud further suggests that people should prepare their prayers properly to facilitate angelic assistance. Right? So, and then he says many Rishonim, many of the medieval commentators supported this sentiment, right? So there are those who say that it's totally permissible to pray to angels. Why would it be permissible to pray to angels if we only believe in one God and one deity?
Because the angels, God made the angels, so they could talk, they could do, but the in between.
Right. Okay. Good. So
as thank you.
Sorry.
The messenger,
the emissaries, right? So there's an understanding that it's permissible because everyone knows you're not really davening, you're not praying to the angels, you're just asking them to help you sort of, you know, put in a good word for me, you know, with the guy up top. And so that's why there are those who are okay with it. However,
how is that different from Christians who say that, you know, the only way to God is through Jesus?
It's not so good. It's a big problem.
It sounds like the same thing.
That's right. That's why there are a lot of people who don't like this. And so therefore, there are many commentators who believe that this is absolutely unacceptable. In particular, anyone want to take a guess who's one of the big people who doesn't like praying to angels? Sorry? Maimonides. He does not like praying to angels, right? This notion of davening and praying to a intermediary source is totally a big no-no. And it's not just the Rambam in this case. There are many who are of the belief that it's really totally unacceptable to pray to angels, and there are those who actually say that it's such an issue praying to angels that when it comes to the text of Shalom Aleichem that many of us say on Friday nights, that when the text that says Baruchunei LaShalom, when we're asking the angels around us to bless us, there are those who take that paragraph out and say there's no, we can't say this because it's not appropriate. The Gra, remember the Gra before who was attacking the Rambam, over here the Gra says take out the text of Baruchunei LaShalom because it's not an appropriate text to say. There are other prayers that we have as well, in particular around the high holiday time we have the Slichos prayer that we say up into Rosh Hashanah, and in the Slichos prayer there is a passage called Machnisei Rachamim, in which if you look in the English translation, it says, "Please, angels of mercy, please bring our prayers up." And so there are those who say that should totally be omitted from the text because of the fact that, again, you're praying to angels and it's not appropriate. As a concluding thought, what I would like to bring out from this final debate and also from the topic of angels in general is that I think more often than not, the source source of people wanting to believe in angels and people wanting to connect to the fact that there are these angelic figures around us and helping us and maybe even pray to them usually comes from a perspective that again, this is not accusatory in any way because we've all done this, but it comes from a perspective in a lacking of understanding of what God truly is. Part of the reason why many of the rabbis and commentators were not into the idea of praying to angels, and part of the reason why angels in general have become more diluted in Jewish literature nowadays is because of the fact that there was a recognition that at some point people were thinking about angels and asking for the help from the angels more than God himself. Right, one of the difficulties that we have in Judaism is that we don't believe that God has a body. We don't believe that God has any sort of corporealness to him. And therefore, as a result, what is God? Where is God? So the answer is that God is everywhere. But that's really intangible, and it's kind of hard to wrap your head around that. So many people like the idea that there's an angel around them and that there is some sort of a spiritual guiding force around them. But the problem with that is that that causes a lacking in understanding of ultimately how we view and understand God. In Judaism, we believe that God is right in front of us at all times, and that we have this image of an angel surrounding us, supporting us. Forget about the angels. Angels are very nice. We have God with us. God is escorting us. God is with us at all times. Forget about praying to the angels to bring your prayer up. God can listen to you directly. In Judaism, we have a very unique perspective that one can pray to God, pray to the master of the universe directly, and that's a very powerful idea. And so at the end of the day, we kind of find, and then we'll take some questions. But at the end of the day, we find that whether or not you want to believe in angels, whether or not you don't, first of all, there's no such thing as not believing in angels, right? You have to sort of redefine them like the Rambam does and say that it's a force in the world and not necessarily an angelic figure. But regardless of what you actually believe in at the end of the day, there is this critical need, I think, that we all have to remind ourselves that the necessity of angels is really It's really unnecessary to think of needing angels on a regular basis because of the fact that Judaism wants us to build that direct connection with God much more than the notion of any other spiritual beings. So ultimately, since this is the conclusion of the two-part series, we'll give everyone a blessing that Hashem should enable us to build that connection with him directly and not allow ourselves to feel the need to have an intermediary, but just to have that direct connection with the Almighty. I thank everyone for joining, and I will take any